Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Calls to defund the police went mainstream with mass protest over the death of George Floyd. Since then, the phrase has become a political tool on the right, trying to scare suburban voters about a breakdown in law and order. But that's not what defund the police actually means. But what are the goals of this effort for police reform, and could they actually make America more safe? We invite you into the conversation. What concerns or hope do you have when you hear that phrase, defund the police? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at TPRSource. We're joined this hour by Rashawn Ray. He's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, sociology professor and executive director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research at the University of Maryland College Park. And Rashawn Ray, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this issue.
Also with us is Rhonda Lord. He's an attorney and founder, now retired, from the Combined Law Enforcement Association of Texas, CLEAT. Rhonda Lord, it's good to have you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And also joining us is Maureen McGuff, and the chief of staff for the policing project at New York University School of Law. Maureen McGuff, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rashawn Ray, tell me what you want people to hear when they hear the phrase defund the police.
I think when people hear the term defund the police, what they should actually hear is reallocate. They should also hear reinvest in local communities. So part of what people have to recognize is that in a lot of cities and municipalities around the country, over 33% of the budget from the general funds goes to law enforcement. And the problem there is that when we look at the clearance rate, meaning violent crime in particular, and the ability for law enforcement to solve violent crime, it's abhorrent. I mean, about 40% of homicides go unsolved, about 70% of robberies and aggravated assaults, about 66% of rapes. And my research suggests that if we reallocate funding to other social services within local governments, it will actually give law enforcement the time, the ability, and the attention to focus on some of the more violent crimes that impact local communities.
Maureen McGuff, when police are used for things other than policing, like what, for example?
Well, so, you know, one of the things that we're seeing today is that we send our officers in to be the first line of defense on a whole host of social problems, you know, from substance abuse to mental illness to homelessness, for which they're ill-equipped and ill-trained and unprepared. And, you know, a lot of the police departments we work with would agree here that we're really setting our police officers up to fail with these expectations.
You know, what about, like, traffic accidents? Why do we need a police officer to show up for something like that?
Well, I'm really glad you asked. You know, one of the programs that we're building here at the Policing Project at New York University School of Law is actually looking at exactly that. You know, something like traffic stops, for example, which account for the highest proportion of police-citizen contacts. What do they actually achieve? Do you need somebody who is an enforcement officer to show up in those circumstances? So we're launching a suite of research projects to help better understand that. We're in line with you on that one.
So just like we have a category of individual who we'll check parking meters to see if you put your, you know, paid your parking. The same thing, we don't need a police officer to do that. So we could also use that type of thinking about traffic accidents.
That's our hypothesis. And it also gets you away from, I mean, one, the risk of escalation and violence, you know, two, over-criminalization and excessive fines and fees, you know, which usually fall on members of society least able to pay them.
Now, Rhonda Lord, you're founded the Combined Law Enforcement Association of Texas, CLEAT, which effectively is this sort of a police union. It was the largest police union here in Texas. And can you talk about, from that perspective, what reform defund the police sounds like to you?
Well, I agree 100% with Dr. Ray and with Maureen. I think that when we have an intelligent conversation about the use of resources, then I think all sides can participate. I think what's happened is we've drifted away from that in many of the debates, and, you know, this defund or get rid of the police, I think, you know, people are welcome to do as they wish. But I would caution, though, while many jobs can be done by better trained people, social workers, and various people, we have to weigh, too, that so many cases turn to violence or people's emotions or alcohol or drugs, that those scenes have to be made safe. So we're not going to get rid of the total police. Many traffic accidents or road rage. So we don't want to put people in risk. But our fire don't go in if there's violence. The EMS doesn't go in. They wait for the police to secure the scene. But most police departments now, it's very difficult to get an officer to come out for a traffic accident if there's no injury or death. I had an accident. Officer dropped off some papers. We both filled them out and we left. So I'm okay with everything that's been said. I would ask before we, you know, get out, we also consider what the cost is. Are you going to have these civilians out 24/7? They're not now. Are you going to have psychologists or psychiatrists or social workers or traffic people working 24/7? They're not now. That's why the police get stuck with a lot of these tasks, is they're open for business, and it's easier to have them take the call, even if they're not the best person to do it.
Rashawn Ray, can you kind of respond to that?
I mean, I completely agree with that assessment. I mean, if you actually ask police officers, and I know everyone on here has worked with hundreds of police officers, if not thousands, as I have, a lot of these calls, they don't want to be responding to either. And part of being open for business, as we just heard, is a great way to think about it, because the officers who I've studied are working 60, 80, 100, 120 hours a week, working tons of overtime, working part-time jobs. I mean, people can't function that way. And I think if we take a market-driven approach to this issue, in some places we might be reallocating funding, which people would call defunding the police, which honestly happens quite a bit more than people think. But then we might also need to shift funding within police department budgets, whether that be for additional source of training, particularly de-escalation training, whether that be for some sort of housing subsidies to make a mandate that officers live in or near the jurisdictions where they work. And one key question you asked earlier is, could America be made safer by this? Yes, I think so. Not only, and America as a whole, not just civilians, but also police officers who are responding to calls for service that they are not prepared to do, that can be outsourced to mental health specialists, to addiction specialists. It doesn't mean that they're not there. But the first initial responders that go in, particularly with the key statistic that 9 out of 10 calls for service have nothing to do with violence at all. Now, it doesn't mean that violence won't happen, but it does mean that it's a large percentage that could be outsourced.
Defund the police is a phrase that arose from the killing of George Floyd at the hands of police. So I think we really should focus in on what can be done to prevent more deaths along those lines. And then also expand out to be thinking, how can we make our communities safer, including safer for police officers and for civilians, and reduce crime at all and protect our property as well. And our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about rethinking police policies along the line of this phrase, defund the police. What does that actually mean? Let's go to some of our callers. If you want to call in, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Michael is on the line. Michael, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to mention an article from BBC News, in which I'm getting this from. It's called George Floyd Death, What U.S. Police Officers Think of Protests. In New York City in 2017, complaints about major crimes fell significantly when police took a seven-week break from proactive policing, resulting in about 2,100 fewer major crime complaints. In 2013, when police in Camden, New Jersey, switched from a warrior to a guardian mentality by redirecting to neighborhood policing, crime rates were cut in half. And I have a point that I like to make, mm-hmm. which is an uncomfortable point, that whenever George Floyd was killed or murdered, that's the crime he's charged with by a police officer, the whole world rose up in protest for months. It's still ongoing because of the atrociousness of that. It's not just that death, but many others. When officers are killed, and I don't want to diminish the value of their function and their lives, but when an officer is killed, there's very little outcry. And that's got to stop. That has to change. But the communities, the public cannot change that. Police have to change that. What can police do to change that balance? They have to change it.
Michael, thank you for the call. Let me go to Maureen McGuff, Chief of Staff at the Policing Project at New York University School of Law. If you could address the first part of Michael's question about the police crime rate going up and down depending on how police perform their duties. Maureen?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, hi. So it's a really great question. And you know, you raised something that I think happens, and it's this false dichotomy of it's either going to be communities safe from police or it's going to be police safe from communities. But when we start to address a lot of these excessive force complaints, we suspect that there'll actually be improved relationships between police and the communities they serve. You know, the issue of use of force is obviously one that's at the forefront, and it should be. You know, currently in the U.S., force is regulated at the state and sometimes the local level. And usually people just speak to the Supreme Court minimal standard, which just says, you know, is the use of force reasonable or not? And I think what's really clear is we need a national standard for use of force for police departments. We need, you know, new criminal and civil actions for excessive use of force. And we need to move beyond that sort of basic constitutional minimum to where police officers are doing everything possible to respect and preserve the sanctity of human life, to avoid unnecessary uses of force, to minimize force use, to prioritize de-escalation, and still to protect themselves and the public. And we suspect that the outcomes of that will not only be, you know, improved safety for communities, but improved safety for officers as well.
Rhonda Lord, attorney and founder with the Combined Law Enforcement of Texas, CLEAT, if you could respond to Michael's other part of the question about the reaction to when we see people who die at the hands of police officers and then the reaction of officers who are killed in the line of duty.
Well, I mean, police officers, about every 56 hours, I believe, someone's killed in the line of duty. And it doesn't make the news nationally, and that's sad. It does impact in communities, and we do see that deal. But I think that what I want people to understand is the police don't enact the law. They are trained to do and enforce the law that the government sets. So if, and I agree in Ferguson that the city government was built around traffic tickets, which fall on poor people and people of color, to run the government. Well, the government, the elected officials and the public can stop that tomorrow. You can make traffic offenses civil matters without the fines. And there are so many things that we back up to the police, but they could have been corrected for decades. And I would just say this about on George Floyd. It's a tipping point, and it's bigger than let's, you know, fire all the Minneapolis police and start over and change their name. It's bigger than that. I really believe it's a tipping point that's got the United States to stop and think about the systemic racism that's built into our criminal justice system. It falls so heavily on people of color and on poor people in our justice system, in our jails, that we have this revolving door. I want to have all of those debates, and I agree with Dr. Ray and Maureen, when we can shift those things and get the police to deal with the things they're trained to do and be there when violence occurs, it'll be so much better for the society and so much better for the police. But we've known these things for so long, and I hope that the George Floyd, the tipping point that moves forward is a much larger discussion and not focused on, well, if we all were Camden, it would be a better world. It won't. We have so many other things that are driving these issues. And like I said, I hope that's the debate and that it continues and that we fix some of these problems, the societal problems.
So, Rhonda Lord, did you see this tipping point coming? Did you see that it's inevitable that eventually the public will have enough of police misconduct, which is a real thing, and that we will have these outbursts of emotion in the streets, which are destructive? And did you see it?
Yes. And I'm not Notre Dame's, but I have been, in a book I wrote a couple of years ago, I was talking about reform and what I thought was coming. I did a 4 or 5 presentations in California and Canada, and I told the police unions that this is we're headed for a tipping point. And my belief is there is a disconnect between what the public expects, how the public expects the police to act, and how the police are trained to act. And that disconnect is causing the public now to see these instances, and they don't like a lot of these things that are happening. But the public is always ahead of elected officials. Women's rights, gay marriage, abortion, all this marijuana. The public moves, and then they put pressure on elected officials to do it. Then the elected officials adjust the laws and order the government workers, including the police, on how to enforce it. So I saw it coming, and I knew that there was going to have to be a reckoning where we stop and start dealing with all of these problems. The training of police, we have one of the most under-trained police in the world. Now, they're well-trained, but they don't compare to Canada or Australia or Europe, where people may spend a year or 2 years being trained to be put on the street. I mean, it's been a battle. Every state has a different system. And I'm for a national data bank. I'm for mandatory federal standards. So no matter where I go in the United States, if I deal with the police, I know that person is trained and meets the standards that's set for the whole United States. But I don't think we have the political will in this country to do that.
Just to be clear, so a person typically who's trained to be a police officer will go through, 8 weeks at an academy?
Yes, 21 weeks, I think. But until the mid-80s, there was no requirement for training at all for the first year. These have been, at least in Texas, we've had a consistent battle from the union side, pushing the government to increase the standards, to get licensing. We have a lot of things here. It's not perfect, but we have way more than other states. But each state line you cross, they may not be licensed. They may have less training, little training. They may go to work without training. It is so inconsistent that there needs to be a floor that says these things must be the minimum for you to carry a badge and have the ability to deprive people of their liberty or their life. And I don't think that goes against states' rights. We mandate alcohol, by holding federal funds, what the alcohol limits will be. We mandate drinking ages. I think we can do the same thing, and that would raise the standard nationally, and then people can do over and above that.
Rashawn Ray, if you could address the concerns about having stricter, more robust training for police officers. Is that part of reform, defund the police?
I think that more training, and in particular, what's being highlighted, I agree with everything that was just said, because it is a particular type of training. So it's extending training for one, but then it's also focusing on the types of training that officers in the United States receive. Officers in the U.S. on average get about 50 hours of firearm training, but they receive less than 10 hours of de-escalation training. So that means when they face pressure, it makes sense why they pull a gun. That's what they've been trained to do. And so part of thinking about putting them in certain environments, I know we've taken up this issue at the Lab for Applied Social Science Research at the University of Maryland, where we have a virtual reality decision-making program that we developed with corporations, and we have departments from across the country participate in it. It helps officers in a safer environment to train, to make better decisions, and to remove bias as part of that. But I mean, we layer up a host of things that's super innovative. We can measure their physiological outcomes, their heart rate, their stress level, their reaction time, their body movement, their eye movement, things that officers really want to know. Like, police officers like data. So part of what we have to do is we have to alter the types of training that they receive. I think part of also thinking about that is a one-off implicit bias training is only going to do so much. I've done a lot of those. They matter in some form, but they don't matter as much. They're diluted unless we deal with the structural elements of policing. And these are some of the broader points that are being made. For example, we need to really work on officer accountability. We need to look hard at qualified immunity. We also need to restructure civilian payouts for police misconduct. Let's take Chicago, for example, one of our cities farther north than, well, maybe not New York, but where Texas is in particular, that in Chicago, they've spent $650 million in police misconduct claims over the past couple of decades. So there are changes that we can make. Training is definitely a large part of it, and we need to ensure that officers are getting de-escalation training and not simply training with firearms, use of force, or to worst case scenarios, because what happens, they show up and these 9 out of 10 calls that could probably be solved with a conversation. And then when they face some type of animosity or resistance, they are trained to use force. And oftentimes these are negative outcomes that we want to prevent so that civilians and officers can get home safely to their families.
And very quickly, in about 2 minutes, if we could, Maureen McGuff, if you could get your reaction to standardization of national training.
I think I'm 100% in agreement with everything that's been said. I'm actually thrilled to hear we're all sort of so close in terms of how we're approaching reform. The other thing I would just encourage people to think about is that, you know, we talked about the mismatch between sort of the training that law enforcement officers receive and the skills that are required for the job. That same mismatch occurs in assessment and hiring and recruitment as well. So if you think about the vast majority of the time that law enforcement officers are expected to be spending, you know, mediating a situation, there's really not a lot of assessment on the front end when someone joins the force as to the extent to which they're able to mediate. You know, how are they inclined to de-escalate situations? What is their emotional intelligence? And that's equally, if not as important as their physical fitness, for example. So it's not enough to revise the training. We also need to revise who we're recruiting and how we're assessing whether or not they're fit for duty.
And you've written about how more women on the force would be a changer.
Absolutely. So there's research out there that shows that compared to their male counterparts, women officers use less force. They use less excessive force when they're on the scene. The men on the scene with them use less force. They're better able to interact with diverse communities. They have better outcomes for crime victims. Communities perceive them as more trustworthy. So, you know, if you think about it, if there was a police training that would offer you all of those outcomes, every agency in the country would probably be voluntarily implementing it. But you know, there's pretty strong research out there that suggests just by increasing the number of women in your ranks, you might have those outcomes as well.
And about how many women typically are on a police force, percentage-wise?
National average is 12%, and it's been that way for a few decades.
And what would you like to see it at?
Well, so it's interesting. I'm part of a movement right now called 30 by 30, where we're trying to get up to 30% of representation in recruit classes by the year 2030. We're not quite pushing for 50-50 parity because we just don't know enough about the propensity of qualified women to become police officers. So by getting to 30% representation, you sort of hit that point of representative bureaucracy where, you know, the fact that women are in the agencies in increased numbers mean they're actually going to be able to positively affect the culture.
We're talking about rethinking policing and defund the police. What does that sound like to you? Does that phrase fill you with hope or does it fill you with dread or fear? We're talking about that right now. You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. You're probably going to be hearing the phrase defund the police a lot in the coming political season. Why? What does it mean? How did this become a political football? And is how that could be a disservice to actually trying to come up with a way to make America safer. We'll get to that point when we come in. We got some callers on the board. We'll get you on the air when we come back from this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about refunding, reforming, defunding the police. Let's go. So I wanted to give Ron DeLord an opportunity to respond to having more women on the police force.
Yes, and I'm so glad to hear that. I wrote a paper, my God, 20 years ago, advocating for increased numbers of women. But I gathered the information from both Australia and Canada, and all of them are double the U.S. in percentage of women. But here's what I found when I bring those things forward. There's going to have to be a structural change in the way the police are set up. And I hear a lot of police chiefs talk about it, but I don't see the action. When females come into the workforce in large numbers like they do in education, then they're set up where females who are going to have the children can take the leave they need. If they're not ready to come back, they can remain with their licensing or training and come back when they're ready. We don't have that set up in the United States. In fact, I'm not aware of hardly anyone in the United States that has female-friendly structure. You leave, you get the medical 12 weeks. If you're not coming back, you're usually gone. And then you can't come back or don't come back. So I want to see a complete change in how we set up a system that works for women who are going to have the children. Many of them are the primary caregivers when the children are young. And how do they do that? Corporate America does it, but we don't seem to have that type of system in the United States that will support having 30, 40, 50% of our police force to be women. If we get to that number, I guarantee you we'll see a different type of policing in America.
Let's go to the calls. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Johnson, thanks for holding on, and you're on the air. Go ahead, Johnson.
Yes, very good topic. By the way, about the women's situation, we've been trying to do that in San Antonio for years. I was a member of the San Antonio Fire and Police Civil Service Commission for a number of years, and that's always been a challenge, but I think we would be better off having more females. But they're not as inclined to adhere to the good old boy network, you know, flexing muscles and that sort of thing. But my real issue goes to the fact that on two occasions in my family, domestic disturbance took place, and of course, police, you know, were called in. And they end up executing a man in both cases. And that has to stop. You know, somehow or another, that's the way that they sell that argument. So it has to be a better way. But my issue really goes to the money that they generate locally, you know, for the coffers. All these politicians, you know, they love the fact that all these fines, and they start the process and the criminal justice system fine people and jerk money out of them right and left. So if the duties of the police are changed, then I'm wondering the impact upon those fines. I hope that doesn't cause people to drag their feet, our politicians, that is. So the question is, to what extent do you believe the money that these folks bring in, the police I'm talking,
okay,
impacts the extent to which we're going to hold on to business as usual?
Got it. Johnson, thank you for your call. I appreciate you called in. Rashawn Ray, can you talk about, you know, with the Brookings Institution, was it fines and things? And I wonder about with self-driving cars, which is just around the corner, what does that mean for policing and all these fines and stuff?
Well, I think that the increasing innovations to technology holds a lot of promise for law enforcement, but simultaneously holds a lot of promise for doubling down on the biases that we see in everyday life. I study these algorithms. One of my colleagues at Brookings, Dr. Nicole Turner Lee, we look at these sort of things, and what we find interesting is that the algorithms simply reflect back what's already happening in society, because people are the ones informing the algorithms and putting the information in, and they oftentimes have gaps and holes in them. So while it seems like the technological advances is a pathway forward, that's not always the case. As an example, just recently, I think over the weekend, there were a group of beachgoers who were being watched through surveillance by the local police department. And then the police department allegedly created racial disparities by choosing who to give tickets to, who didn't have on a mask or who didn't have on proper clothing on the beach. speech. These are the sort of things that we continue to see play out. But as it relates to funding in particular, as technology increases, maybe it's not simply about reallocating funding away from police departments. I think in a lot of places that is the case when we look at clearance rates, when we look at calls for service. But it could also be about shifting funding within the police department budget to kind of scale up the base, whether that be for family-friendly policies, which is one of the things we just heard. It could also be for higher pay to make a qualification that people need a college degree. People who have a college degree oftentimes have better communication skills. They're a little bit older than, say, an 18, 19, and 20-year-old to come onto the force. But then also housing can make a big difference. If we really want to re-envision policing, part of engaging in community policing, which is a term that people say all the time, and in people's minds, what they picture is an officer playing football or basketball with a kid. That's not community policing. That's just a police officer playing football or basketball with a kid. Community policing is an experience. It's about people living in the community, talking to neighbors, attending places of worship there, sending their kids to local schools, grocery shopping there, exercising there. And that, I think, will make a big transformation in some of the outcomes we see as it relates to racial disparities in policing.
Let's go to another caller, James. And James, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I'm a member of Fix SAPD, a nonpartisan organization in San Antonio. We're working to repeal chapters 143 and 174, which you can learn more about at fixsapd.org. These laws make it nearly impossible to fire bad cops in San Antonio, and our police chief has said outright that these laws contribute to police misconduct. We stand out as one of the worst cities to keep bad officers fired, and we continue to be held hostage by our police union and their supporters like Mr. DeLord, who helped craft their contract. If we can remove these laws and the police union contract, our city can come to the negotiation table as equals and hold bad cops accountable. My question is, on a national scale, what should city contracts with police departments have to give power back to the people and hold bad officers accountable? Thank you.
Rhonda Lord, attorney and founder of the Combined Law Enforcement Associations of Texas, CLEAT. If you could talk about unions, and some people say, as our caller points out, unions have held back abilities to reform and also remove what they call bad apples.
Sure. And let me just say this. People have a right to do whatever they want in the petition drive, but they don't have a right to their own facts. The chief fired 71 people over a 10-year period. Of that 71, only 10 got their jobs back. So it's not the chief is winning 80-85%, and that's true throughout most of the state. In the majority of departments in the state, they're at-will employees. They don't have a union or a contract. So when people say they've opposed reform, that's not correct in Texas. And now, you and I may disagree about one particular thing. You may want X and I may not. But that doesn't make us opposed to reform. We always should be looking at the police, and we should be looking at the hiring, and we shouldn't have obstacles that protect people who don't need to be a police officer. But we also have trust that we should have a due process system that can weigh. The chief is not always correct. I like the chief. I think he's a good guy. But he's pushed by politics and other decision-making. So when you say you can't fire anybody, pretty much everyone the chief fired stayed fired.
There are lots of examples of when that didn't happen. And particularly the police officer who served the homeless person a feces sandwich. Also, there have been efforts in the legislature to help provide more public information about what goes on with police officers and what happens when suspects die in their custody. And CLEAT has been continually trying to prevent that that reform from happening.
Well, I've been retired for a decade, and I don't run the union anymore, but I can list a litany of things of which we did to improve the quality. We supported racial and cultural diversity. We supported video cameras. We supported mandatory training, all on the union side. And you can take any one case. You can take one person who's acquitted by a jury and say, well, we need to get rid of the jury system. I don't disagree that if people get due process, some cases will fall through the cracks. But that officer was fired anyway. But you don't
wipe out a different system. For a different occurrence.
I understand. That's one officer in 10 years, 2,500 policemen making millions of contacts a year. And in 10 years, you got one case, you didn't like the outcome, and he was terminated anyway. I'm okay. Do as you wish. I'm just saying it's not a, you're not correct on the statistics. You may be correct on your own opinion.
And in about 30 seconds, because I got to hit a break, Rashawn Ray, your reaction?
I think the broader point is that there are oftentimes policies at the state level. And in Texas, we're hearing about that. In Maryland, we have LIBOR, which is Law Enforcement Bill of Rights, that prevents police chiefs and local agencies from taking action against law enforcement. What we need is a national database, and that's something that's also received bipartisan support.
All right, we're taking a break, and we'll come back. We'll take up more calls. We got voicemails, a lot to talk about concerning defunding and rethinking police. If you want to call in, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also tweet at us at TPRSource. And we'll be back after this one-minute break. Stay tuned. Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about defunding the police or rethinking policing. We have a voicemail from Fran.
Hi, this is about the police reform or defunding. My name is Fran, and I would suggest that police officers in neighborhoods that are composed of people of color get out of their car and get to know the people. Like the saying goes, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Well, police officers, they are the hammer. And if they don't know people in the neighborhoods they're policing, everybody's going to look like a criminal. So get out and talk to people. And I am an African-American woman. I don't hate the police. I've had some actually good interactions with the police. But I think we clearly can't go on like this, so we need to get to know each other.
All right, and let me go to a caller, and this is Barbara. Barbara, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I am so excited about the idea of changing the wording from defunding to reallocating and going to other services that are absolutely necessary in our city. I have seen it many times, and even as a teacher, when you think in terms of, you know, you have to be the counselor, you have to be the teacher, you have to be the mother, you have a lot of roles to play as a teacher, and I cannot imagine the number of roles that the police have to pay. Play in regard to our public service. And I appreciate everything that they do. You know, it's just the way it is. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call. Maureen McGuff, Chief of Staff at the Policing Project at New York University School of Law. As you were an advocate for front-end accountability, how would that make policing more effective and safer for communities?
Absolutely. So front-end accountability is a really big component of how we're sort of reimagining the idea of first response. So if you think about a lot of other government entities, there's always a public comment period, right? Government agencies sort of, you know, put out their policies, their intended practices, and the public has an opportunity to shape what those policies are. In police, we really lack a sort of systemic way to achieve that kind of public input. You know, at most, if you have some type of public accountability, it's usually at the back end, you know, after something pretty egregious has gone wrong. And what we're trying to do by building front-end accountability is, you know, helping the public have a meaningful say in how they're policed, because that's just basic democratic governance. So, you know, we did a lot of work with the Camden Police Department in reforming their use of force policy, and the community was at the table every step of the way to help understand, you know, the impact of police practices and what it is they wanted to see from the people who were supposed to be serving them.
Let's go to, we have another voicemail, and this is from Valerie.
Hi, this is Valerie Reifert of San Antonio, Texas. I am a 32-year-old Black woman, mother to a beautiful 2-year-old son. I actually wrote a letter to Chief McManus back in 2016, I believe, after Trayvon Martin's murder. And I asked him to make a stand for San Antonio and say that, you know, no police brutality here. And if a person of color is killed unjustly, that there will be justice brought to them. And McManus and I have not been able to have that conversation quite yet, but as somebody who's been out at the protests, I can say what I've seen has been beautiful, and it's given me hope. There is a lot more work to do, you know, with the argument of Black Lives Mattering on social media, but I have a lot of hope, and I really, really need us to keep this theme and momentum going up to the polls and through November as well. So thank you so much.
All right. And this is, let's go to the calls with Ariel. Ariel, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. And excuse my hoarseness. Going back to the lady who talked about the hammer and the nails, I would like to see us get rid of the expression law enforcement. Think about the word force there. The people who do it tend to abuse it. The people who receive it certainly resent it. Come up with some other expression, you know, I don't know, peace assistance or whatever, but get rid of the phrase law enforcement. Thank you.
Rashawn Ray, is there a mindset issue with policing in America where they are sometimes trained to be occupational forces and not policing, protect and serve?
Most definitely. I mean, most law enforcement officers, even using that term, they are trained oftentimes in a warrior culture, a warrior mindset, rather than a guardian mindset. It's something that they talk a lot about. And even if we look at a city like Minneapolis, where they had banned certain types of practices, chokeholds and the like, the Fraternal Order of Police was still teaching a warrior course that led to dozens of residents of Minneapolis being choked out. And I think part of what we're talking about is we need to reimagine policing. If people seen what happened in Portland, just as one example over the weekend, I mean, these are the types of things that should not be happening when people are peacefully enacting their First or Second Amendment rights. But I think in this moment, we are in a racial awakening, as we've been hearing. And 70% of white people now view racism as a thing, like it's a real thing. And I think it's a statistic that really bears this out. I mean, black people are 3.5 times more likely than whites to be killed by police when they're not attacking or have a weapon. And so part of what we have to do is not just focused on the bad apples like Derek Chauvin and others, but we have to focus on what I call the rotten tree of policing that has its roots back to the founding of our country. But if we want to do it, we have to focus on the structure. I think that we have to deal with civilian payouts. We have to deal with qualified immunity. And then I think there are two very important things that can have to happen on a local level. First is to ensure that a civilian is on the trial board. So oftentimes when we have these civilian oversight committees, a lot of police chiefs are fine with those because they realize that they are symbolic in nature. They don't really have any real impact on holding officers accountable internally. People pay their tax money. They should know what's going on. And I think that transparency will build trust and equity. And I think the other thing is we need to ensure that bad apples are held accountable. That can include a local list of, and maybe it doesn't include the specific officer's name, but it could include a list of infractions coming from a police department. And then finally, we need to ensure that we have what I call gap protections. These are good apple protections. There are a lot of officers who speak up and speak out all the time, and they get vilified and stigmatized for it internally. I work with a lot of officers who try to bring up allegations against other officers, and their careers are the ones that derailed. So if we want officers to get better, we have to provide them with the structural elements so that policing as an institution changes and we don't just focus on them as individuals.
Bad apples. We hear that phrase all the time, and with apologies to the Jackson Five, one bad apple will spoil the whole barrel. We know that in reality, and we use that as a metaphor. And it happens in also if you have a bad apple in a police force, does that person become a burden for the entire, the spear, the corps? Ron DeLord, a bad apple, a individual who's acting inappropriately, who breaks the law. How easy or hard should it be to be able to police the police?
Well, it's one of the things of which we're going to have to, have a discussion on. And I think that human nature, there are going to be people who violate their oath, and we've got to be in a position. Did I lose you?
No, sir, you're fine.
I'm sorry. I'm just having phone trouble. I think I agree with Dr. Ray. I think that we have to look at the police. And just a side note, you got 2,500 officers and 1.4 million people in San Antonio with 1,000 less officers than you have in Dallas with less population. You're not going to have time to stop and do the things that we could be doing. But as you release some of these burdens, then the police will have more time. But I do believe in due process, and I think that's negotiable. And I do believe that the officers are held accountable now. And I will tell you my experience. I don't know about all the United States. Police officers probably file more complaints against other officers than come from outside the department. I know they do in Austin, and officers, I think today, are not going to tolerate misbehavior. Now, human beings, priests, teachers, every job in the world, there are people who fail. And we are open to discussing how do we deal with that, how do we identify those people, and how do we protect the public.
Now, we're seeing the politicization of this issue. Maureen McGough, if you could talk about what people need to hear when they see these types of phrases being thrown around in political ads.
You're talking about the phrase defunding specifically?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really important is, defund is not our favorite term because it's not really accurate. I love Rahsaan's framework of reallocation. A lot of times, too, defunding is said in the same breath as abolition, and that's not at all what I think most of us are advocating for. You know, really, when we're talking about defunding, we're talking about reimagining what first response looks like and making sure the right people with the right tools are meeting the social service needs of a community. It doesn't mean completely eliminating, the law enforcement function. There will be sort of discrete scenarios where that is absolutely appropriate and necessary, but it's not nearly as prevalent as you would believe now. And so what we want to do is we want to make sure that people understand, as public citizens, they have a right to be served by their government in a way that is helpful, in a way that doesn't over-criminalize them, and in a way that actually meets their underlying needs. And that's what we're trying to accomplish through reimagining first response.
And finally, Rahsaan Ray, do you want people to be talking about this in their everyday conversations so that we can come to a better understanding? We have about 30 seconds.
Sure, I think so. I think this conversation is really important. I completely agree with the other guest about how we think about defunding. And again, I think highlighting reallocation, highlighting reinvesting in local communities is the pathway forward when we sit at policy tables.
Rahsaan Ray is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. And he also with us is Ron DeLord, attorney, founder, and retired from the Combined Law Enforcement Association of Texas, CLEATS, and Maureen McGough, chief of staff at the Policing Project at New York University School of Law. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.